The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Show. It's the show that Mark Twain once called smarter'n a blue jay what can talk possum and faster'n a naked fat man riding a bolt of lightning.
So here's your plain-spoken homespun host, Eric Metaxas.
Yeah, hey there, folks. I'm not much with words, but we try to, you know, we try to get out the basic ideas to the folks. Today, I am very excited to have in the studio my friend Rich Lowry. You know him as the editor-in-chief of the National Review, but today he's here in two other capacities. A, as my friend. B, as the author of a brand new and very important book titled The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. Rich Lowry, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Eric. How's it going?
Well, it's always fun to talk to you for many reasons. I want to talk to you about current events, impeachment, and all that kind of stuff, but it's not as though those things are unrelated to the subject of your book. So why don't we at least start by telling my audience, what do you mean when you say the case for nationalism, how it made us powerful, united, and free? Talk a bit about the difference between nationalism and patriotism and the misunderstanding that we have because of the culture, the cultural coverage of it.
Yeah, so a lot of people lazily think that patriotism is the word for everything good about national loyalty, national feeling, nationalism is everything bad. And that's an unsustainable definition. You want to get technical about it, patriotism, the root of it is the Latin word patre, same root as patriarchy.
Bingo.
Father, fatherland, loyalty to your own, you know, which is an important natural thing. Nationalism is more specific. It's the idea or doctrine that a distinct people united by common culture, common history, very often a common language, should govern a distinct territory. And that idea, I believe, created the modern world and had a huge role in the creation of modern democracy.
What do you know, Rich? let me just say, you know, not only do I agree with you, but where I come to the subject has to do with the Nazis and Hitler. In other words, they clearly gave nationalism a bad name because what they did went way beyond nationalism. So to call nationalism that kind of nationalism is to be foolish and fundamentally wrong-headed. But we have for 3+ years been dealing with a mainstream media that refuses to see the nuanced meanings of nationalism and immediately thinks of nationalism as white nationalism, racial nationalism. How is nationalism racial when America has never been founded on racialist principles?
Right. So this is the key thing. Nationalism is not small-minded. It's a loyalty that's above sect, above tribe, above race, above partisanship. And it's a key part of the American experience. The American Revolution is a nationalist revolution. The key claim is that we have our own nation and it should govern itself. It shouldn't be part of the British Empire. You don't get the drafting and ratification of the Constitution, which creates a strong and capable government without the nationalists pushing for it, George Washington and Alexander Hamilton. You don't get victory in the Civil War without nationalism. And it's the key event, obviously, undergirding the legitimacy of the American nation state. So in the United States, this is not a nasty tradition. It runs through Hamilton, it runs through Lincoln, it runs through TR. You see some of it in FDR and Reagan. So it's a plastic tradition. Both parties or different ideologies can tap into it, but you can't if you have a cosmopolitan view of the world, that you're a citizen of the world, and all the nations are these tribal institutions that you're above. And this is really a fantastical way to view the world. Because the way I think about it, you get in a jam anywhere around the world, you get kidnapped by pirates or something, it's not the world that comes to save you, it's your country that comes and saves you, because the country cares about you more than anyone else does. There's no universal military, universal nation, or universal language.
Well, what we're talking about, this is the very heart of the issue of what we're discussing, and the issue that we're discussing is at the very heart of the global conversation we're having right now. The reason this president was elected was because even when he wasn't speaking about it specifically, he was, by talking about America first, by talking about being nationalistic and patriotic, he was, in effect, opposing this, you called it cosmopolitan, globalist agenda that seeks to undermine American sovereignty, borders, all of the things that most of the West has taken deeply seriously until suddenly now.
Right. So this basically what happened is the Democrats, who have a nationalist tradition themselves, turned their back on it completely. And Republicans lost touch with it under the influence of libertarianism, under the influence of a business elite that's increasingly transnational in its attitudes and worldview, and under the influence of an overly idealistic policy, a foreign policy under George W. Bush. So you had this hugely powerful and important baton just sort of left on the ground. And Donald Trump picks it up and says, we're going to protect our own people and our own interests. And that feels like a revelation because no one else is saying it.
Okay, this is huge because you're tapping into the diehard never Trumpers, whether it's David Frum or a lot of the people that 10 minutes ago we would have considered friends. They are suddenly revealed to be in bed with elite corporate interests. In other words, suddenly you realize these people who have been around us, in fact, are clinging to a different flag than the American flag. When you talk about transnational corporations, I have never in my life thought much about this, or now that I've thought about it a little bit, been deeply frightened at what that kind of power means, for example, to the sovereignty of the United States. When I see Google effectively acting for Google and not for the United States, and not only not for the United States, but perhaps for China, or I see Spotify or other big organizations doing things that seem to me antithetical to fundamental American values, I suddenly wonder, what can we do about it, and what might the founders have thought, and did the founders put anything into the Constitution to guard against this? Because this is the danger of our time.
Yeah, so this is a totally new phenomenon. Because the business innovations and new technologies, 19th, early 20th century, they served to create a national loyalty and attachment over and above local loyalties and attachments. And there are downsides to that, but it was a nationalizing trend. Now, in the late 20th, early 21st century, the same sort of business changes and technological innovations are creating a transnational attitude. And the other really important thing that happened is cosmopolitanism used to be the attitude of the outsiders. Diogenes, this philosopher in Athens, lived in a pot in the marketplace to outrage the bourgeoisie. And he's the first recorded person in history to say, I'm a citizen of the world, which is a senseless statement then because every five-year being was so caught up in the polis. But that attitude of philosophers and critics and outsiders began to seep into the mainstream of our elite beginning in the 60s and the 70s. So we now have a denationalizing elite, a denationalizing governing elite to a large extent, which is unprecedented in human history. And the natural human tendency, you lie about the other guys. You know, the French lie about the Germans. Not that you need to lie about them to make them look very bad. The Germans lie about the French. But what we're doing now is lying about ourselves. And that's something totally new.
This is so important, Rich. I know you know it because you wrote a book about it, but I want my audience to know what we're talking about is extraordinarily important. It is ultimately important. The book is The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. We're going to talk a lot more about this, Rich, because I wanted to take the time because part of the problem is that we're living in a media culture that now traffics in cliches. In other words, we've seen a number of trends over the decades and the years. One of them, as you say, is this gradual abandonment of the idea of sovereignty and patriotism and nationalism. And it never happened dramatically, so most people haven't noticed it. And most people have drifted into this idea, which appears anodyne and can be anodyne, but ultimately becomes pernicious, of being I'm a citizen of the world. And we have to remember how important it is to love one's country and to understand what one's country is. Is one's country the leadership of that country? Are the Iranian people Iran, or is it the mullahs? These are the kinds of things that if we don't think about this deeply now, we're in big trouble. Folks, the book is The Case for Nationalism. Really, really important. Rich Lowry is my guest. Don't go away.
Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane. Vixen and Blixen and all his reindeers pulling on the reins. Bells are ringing, children singing, all is merry and bright. So hang your stockings and say your prayers, cause Santa Claus comes tonight.
Hey there, folks. Now, Santa Claus is a citizen of the world. I'm fine with that, all right? I'm not going to give you an argument on that. But we're talking about something different. I'm talking to Rich Lowry. The new book, very important, folks. It's called The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. I find it interesting, Rich, Ann Coulter is the sort of person who will double down on something unpopular. You're not typically that kind of person. For you to write a book about nationalism at a time like this, I thought this is very interesting. What made you feel the need to do that?
Well, it was occasioned by Donald Trump. It's not a book about Trump, but I got thinking about the topic after his first inaugural address, wrote a column about it, then wrote a piece about it with one of my colleagues, just defending the basic idea, and then really delved into it because it's a fascinating topic. It's an endlessly rich topic, and it's a widely misunderstood topic. And there's just this lazy idea that nationalism is synonymous with hatred and with warfare, and this is just completely wrong. And any form of human organization is flawed because humans are fallen beings, but it's not as though, you know, the polis and Greece was a peaceful institution. It's not as though if a tribes are peaceful institutions, they're the opposite. You go further up the scale, empires have all been undemocratic, and they haven't been peaceful either. So I think the nation state is the most natural element of human organization, and the rise of it coincided with modern democracy. Because in the 19th century, the nationalists were liberals. They believed in common citizenship and popular sovereignty, and were defending the rights of their nations against either overweening monarchs who thought they owned the nation or against empires who were ruling the nation without democratic consent. And so this is just a hugely important phenomenon to our world, and people need to know what it is.
Okay, so I think part of the problem and the central issue is to define what is nationalism, what does it mean to be an American. The reason I say this is because I've noticed that the slippage and the confusion, we saw this very recently with the NBA, let's say, right? This is a gigantic, powerful, super wealthy, growing organization. The leaders in that organization, and especially the players, have not taken time, rather obviously, to think through what any of these things mean. So when there are protests for freedom in Hong Kong, which are more American than much of what we've seen in America, the idea that these wealthy, influential people could not understand why they needed to rally to that cause, why they didn't need to defend the totalitarian Chinese, it's a staggering moment.
Yeah.
It's a clarifying moment for everybody. That's how far we've drifted.
Yeah, so you get the sense that there's a greater loyalty or at least deference to China than to the United States on the part of all these businesses. And the NBA, of course, in the end of the day, is a business. And that's just outrageous. And a key nationalist insight is just how incredibly grateful we should be for this nation. Most of us, all of us, we didn't do anything to be born here. One of the greatest boons in all of world history, we didn't do anything to build this nation. We didn't sign the Declaration of Independence or draft the Constitution, or many of us didn't march, you know, in Martin Luther King's March on Washington. That's all been bequeathed to us. And we need to be deeply grateful and concerned with protecting it and its interests and passing it on to the next generation. So you see these businesses chasing the next marginal dollar in China. and that loosening their feeling of attachment to us, which is just crazy. Like, the NBA is already successful, right? It's just they get dollar signs, the additional marginal dollar sign in their eyes and clouding what should be obvious insights.
I find this fascinating that we have two conservative Republicans talking about the downside of greed. Here we are. We've come to a place where we understand what Tocqueville and many others have understood, that the free market is great and making money is great. We want to expand the wealth and help everyone. But at some point, there are other values that have to come in. And if you kick those other values to the curb, it becomes mere greed. It becomes destructive, and it becomes fundamentally anti-freedom. The idea that the NBA would get in bed with China, that is doing innumerable horrific things to its own citizens. In the past, I would think that any American would know, wait a minute, if I can make money building the Nazi ovens, I don't want that money. If I can make money oppressing people in a foreign land, that's dirty money. If I can make money off the slave trade in a foreign country, people used to know when money was dirty, and they had the dignity and the virtue to say no thank you. So what has happened that suddenly some of the most powerful figures in this nation seem actually ignorant of this entire concept?
Yeah, I just think the cosmopolitan trends we were talking about a little earlier have kind of loosened the sense of attachment and loyalty among a lot of people, and that attitude is much broader than just the governing elite. So things that would have been unquestioned are up for grabs now. And something that I've been shocked, Eric, that I got a lot of blowback for in the book and get been called racist for, is just I emphasize how important the common culture is as well as this glue that keeps us together. Like very basic things, a commitment to the flag, to our founding fathers and common heroes, speaking the same language, which is hugely important. If you don't have one dominant language, with few exceptions, Switzerland would be an exception, it tends to tear your country apart. We almost saw it in Canada, 20 years ago, where you have Quebec, a French-speaking province, plopped into this English-speaking country and developed its own culture on that basis and then wants to govern itself on that basis and almost tears nice, pleasant Canada, where nothing bad happens, apart. You see it in Spain now, the contention over the status of Catalonia, speaks its own language, has its own culture. So language is just hugely important and something that can encompass everyone, right? Immigrants learn how to speak English, right? Your forebears came here and learned how to speak English.
Well, my forebears are in Connecticut now. They might be listening to the show. And I got to tell you, that's the point. Something happened when assimilation was thought to be oppressive, an annoyance, and a betrayal of someone's origins. That is the end of a nation. When you begin bringing people in who no longer desire to assimilate to the culture, and when we say assimilate to the culture, obviously we mean to an extent. You'll right. always have your accent. Right. You'll always have your love of your home. But this is the kind of thing that has happened in the last 50 or so years that's very dramatic, and it didn't happen overnight. So the idea that you would be called a racist or something for talking about culture, let's talk about culture for a moment, Rich, because I've written about this myself. This is the sort of thing that was taken for granted, and perhaps because it was taken for granted, we never explicated it and never clarified it. But students used to learn to love and admire our heroes, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, right. down the line. Something happened in the 60s where that kind of shifted. We no longer really celebrate heroes. We no longer recite, whether it's the Pledge or Longfellow's Paul Revere's Ride. Right. We've kind of abandoned that love of country. And I think it's why we're here.
Yeah, so two things. Just going back to assimilation quickly, one thing that I was just astonished by when I delved into, so we had this big wave of immigration, largely from Europe, late 19th, early 20th century, a strain on the system. But every elite institution in American life was concerned with assimilating those immigrants, whether it's corporate America, the philanthropic institutions, the school systems, everyone. And that is now totally gone. And you have every elite institution actually tilting the other way. We have another big wave of immigration, but none of these institutions are concerned with assimilating these immigrants, which is a big and concerning change. And in terms of the education system, it's doing the exact opposite of what it should be doing. It's telling our children lies about this country, and it's based on the idea that this country is illegitimate in some deep sense, that our sins overwhelm anything good about America or Americans. And this is something we just have to resist with every fiber of our being. And another thing I learned in the course of researching the book, really history education as we came to know it in the schools arose in the post-Civil War environment, because the veterans of the Civil War, like, we need to teach our country's story to our children. We need to have flags at every school. We need to have a Pledge of Allegiance. All that is a post-Civil War phenomenon of this great nationalist period prior after the Civil War, and it's all washed out beginning in the 60s.
It's the hippies of the 60s who took over the institutions, the long march through the institutions, they have created a deeply embedded, I would say, perfidious narrative, destructive, tremendously destructive narrative. And those of us who dare to speak against it are derided as bigots and worse. It's a strange pass. It's important we talk about it. The book is The Case for Nationalism by Rich Lowry. Don't go away.
To you and all your family, your neighbors and your friends, may all your days be happy with the joy that never ends. May peace and love surround you at Christmas time and all the whole year through.
Hey folks, that's David Cassidy, in case you're scoring at home. I'm talking to Rich Lowry, and the book is called The Case for Nationalism. Rich, I want to congratulate you on writing a book on this important, complex concept of nationalism. We were talking about common culture and really how we're at a place where we have to define what is a nation, what are these globalist tendencies, where do they lay? My question to you would be, it's kind of like when we were talking, we've talked at other times about religious liberty. I have made the case that the mainstream media and the reigning culture is, in effect, trying to do something unconstitutional by establishing a religion, but they don't call it a religion. But when they are trying to enforce views about the human person or sexuality, same-sex marriage or whatever, when they're trying to enforce it using the power of the government, it becomes effectively like the establishment of religion, and they have to be careful not to do that. Similarly, I would say that we have, you talked about empires, we have something like a globalist empire, whether Soros is the emperor, I don't know, but somehow it has a huge effect, and for the first time, we're having to define what does it mean to be America, and then when do we need to push back against those globalist forces? It seems to me a new moment in our history.
Yeah, so the legitimacy of the nation state is under threat. And you see it most starkly in Europe, where there's this big supranational project to eventually wipe out effectively borders and create one governing institution. And this is a long-running European dream that goes back to the Romans, goes back to Charlemagne, goes back to Napoleon, goes through Hitler. This is obviously a much more mild and benign version than those, but it's a quasi-imperial project.
I'm not sure that it's more benign than anything except Hitler. I don't know that Napoleon and those others were more dangerous, let's say, to the average German or Greek than what we see happening now. Which is why I've been a cheerleader for Brexit and any time any of the nations push back against the EU.
Yeah. So the idea that England, one of the most astonishing successes in self-government and leaders in this version of nationalism I write about in the book, should be governed by any other entity or any other capital other than, from Westminster is crazy. It's absolutely insane. Why should Brussels rule England? And if you'd put this to the English any time throughout the centuries, they would have said, okay, yeah, if you want to do that, we'll fight you. So it's hugely important that this project, that Brexit, succeed. And it's actually – we've learned more about why you should be concerned and worried about the EU during this process, because they made it as hideously difficult to exit as possible, because they don't want anyone else to get the idea, oh, I can do this too. And, you know, no offense, I don't think Greece is a very well-governed place, but at least the Greeks should do it, right? They should figure out what their destiny is.
Well, it's kind of funny you say that, because having traveled to Greece every year and being Greek – I've thought about this a lot. I've thought about how they have suffered. And the siren song of money, that's ultimately what we're talking about, Rich. The lure of the almighty a dollar or a euro, whatever it is. Many people followed that. And I think that is the pernicious part of when people talk about I'm a free marketer, I'm whatever. I think that we're facing a moment where if we do not define the limits of mm-hmm. when that is good, how that is good, it becomes destructive. I think the same thing happens, obviously, to the NBA. They want to make more money.
Right.
And so suddenly they cast aside anything but how can we expand right. into other markets, even if those markets have slave labor and have zero respect for human rights right. and on and on and on. So we're talking about a lot of things. It's as I said earlier, a clarifying moment. I didn't know that you were pro Brexit. What do you think is going to happen there?
I think, astonishingly, I've been fairly pessimistic about it for a while, because my basic insight was once you delay it, it gets easier to delay, and then it never happens. But I think Boris Johnson, the man, might meet his moment here. We'll know more in about a week and see how the election goes. But I'm pretty optimistic he'll win a majority that will be pro-Brexit enough either for him to get a good deal or just to leave. And just leaving without a deal, there would be economic turmoil. I don't know how much or how bad. But in the scheme of things, whatever it is worth it to keep the UK as a sovereign, self-governing entity the way it's been.
But that's the point. There are many people that say that nothing's worth it. In other words, the heroism that you saw in Churchill, the heroism that you've seen throughout history where freedom dares to say we will pay any price, we will bear any burden, even from Democratic presidents in the U.S., there was a heroic instinct that I'm willing to sacrifice something for something greater. The dollar wipes that away.
Yeah.
And that's my horror at the NBA turning a blind eye to the nefariousness of China. But you see it across the board.
Yeah, so this is the key thing is I'm very pro market guy. But that I don't think there's anything any such thing as an atomized individual who can stand on his or her own. Now, individual liberty is hugely important. It's part of our national tradition from the very beginning. But you need to be connected to family. You need to be connected to church. You need to be connected to community. You need to be connected to nations. All these things give your life meaning. And one thing that we're experiencing in this country where life expectancy is in the decline, it's not the government that's doing that. It's kind of a toxic individualism of unconnected people who aren't married or aren't part of the civic
fabric.
Hang
on, this is a huge subject, folks. I know you're not going away. We'll be right back.
Shining in the green day, I wait for it to roll your eyes.
Hey there, folks. Yes, that's Dean Martin singing Marshmallow World. And if you want to see me and Victoria Jackson sing Marshmallow World, you're going to have to tune into the TBN Christmas Variety Crazy TV special coming up soon. Oh, it's insane. I'm talking to Rich Lowry about really important things. Rich, you were just making the case, a lot of stuff here, about what happens when the American strain of individualism goes too far. And you were just talking about all kinds of social decay. Keep talking.
Yeah, so I think the way libertarians, and this is reductive and oversimplified, but the way libertarians view the world, it's the relationship between the government and the individual. And the individual needs to win that struggle. The way progressives view the world, basically the same way, and it's the government that needs to control the individual. The way a true conservative views the world is, yeah, the government and individual are important, but there's this huge intermediary space, that's civic life, that's hugely important. It may not determine whether we're free or not the way the relationship of government to the individual does, but it will determine whether we're happy or not. because if you have total individual autonomy, you might think that's great, but you're probably going to be lonely. And if you're going to be lonely, you're going to be unhappy, then you're going to get addicted to drugs, you're going to drink, you might commit suicide. And this is what we see in huge swaths of America, and it's why it's an almost unprecedented trend in a country that is so wealthy to see this basic metric of social health, life expectancy, going in the wrong direction.
Well, you know, this gets to Burke's Little Platoons, I guess, right?
Right? Of course.
I mean, talk about that, because a lot of people listening, they haven't heard of Burke or Little Platoons, but Chuck Colson talked about this all the time. It's at the very heart of everything we're talking about, and because we don't talk about this, people either go in this direction or this direction. So what is in the middle? What do you mean by
yeah,
Little Platoons?
Yeah, so it's families, community, it's church, all of which create a mutual bond of obligation and are influences in our lives that tend to make us virtuous. So freedom's hugely important. Virtue is also really important. You need both, and they can be in tension. But one of the geniuses of the American experiment is that we've had both throughout our history, because we've had a wide latitude for freedom, but also, in contrast to a lot of countries around the world, this part of our exceptionalism, a really robust civic life. This is what one of the things that Tocqueville wrote about, you know, in his masterpiece about America in the 19th century. And what's happened is that that middle part has eroded, and we're paying the price. And there's not an easy way to reverse it, but it's something we have to be really focused on.
This is, again, so important. I could just spit. I won't, but it's so important.
Is that what you do when things are important?
Nah. I remember when I was probably in sixth grade, in our social studies class, our history class, we watched a film called The Man Without a Country. And it was like maybe a 30 or 40 minute film about a man who, for whatever reason, had decided he didn't want to be part of it. And so he floats around on this boat. And it was, you know, today the progressives would call it propaganda. But it was such a poignant idea that mm-hmm. this was a man who had somehow abdicated his American citizenship and floated around the world, and he didn't have a country. And I think to myself now, people would celebrate that. They would say, look, I'm a man mm-hmm. of the nations. I'm a man of the world, international. And I think that there are a number of elements to this kind of globalist worldview that are interesting. I find that often people with that worldview tend toward anti-Semitism or toward hating Israel and the U.S., perhaps yep. because in some ways we represent the clearest example of how their system doesn't work.
Yeah, well, with Israel and the United States are two of the most robustly nationalistic countries in the world. And I have a chapter on ancient Israel in the book, which I think in the Anglo-American experience was really the seedbed of nationalism. And the Israeli nation begins with a promise of a God to Isaiah. I'll make of thee a great nation.
Abraham.
Yeah, Abraham.
I know you said that.
I'll make of thee a great nation.
Yeah.
And, you know, Abraham and Sarah are, 99 years old?
Isn't it amazing? I mean, that God creates this idea.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing.
And there's a passage in there somewhere where he sets out the borders of ancient Israel, and it's like a surveyor. It's like, it's going to go around this hill and then down south here, and then it cuts west and comes back up. And it's obviously, it's more than a nation, right? It's the religion and the covenant setting out a relationship with God. But it has many of the hallmarks of the nation, and even an aspect of popular sovereignty, and the fact that the law applies to everyone, not just the elite, to everyone. But the Bible, and the fact that the King James Bible was on the bedstand of every American settler, hugely important in our country, still sets out our national identity today, gives us the idea that we're chosen people, or as Abraham Lincoln said, an almost chosen people, that we live in a promised land, and the idea of the covenant, which is hugely important. You get the first, you know, obviously the Mayflower Compact, then every little town and church that's founded in America is done with the covenant, and the most important covenant is the Constitution. And obviously something that's unique about the covenant is kind of a limit on God, because if you fulfill your obligations, he's going to have obligations to you, and you see that, an echo of that idea in in the Constitution, which creates a strong and capable national government, which is hugely important, but also creates limits on it as well, which is also hugely important.
Well, and the other thing that we must not forget, you see it at the heart of the biblical covenant that God has with Israel, and at the heart of the new America that the founders give us in the Constitution, is this fundamental idea that we have obligations toward God, that somehow freedom, it's not freedom to do anything, but it's freedom to do the right thing, and that all of our leaders are equally responsible before God. So it's the best kind of egalitarianism in the sense that we are all under God, which is why we can and will flourish, because we have chosen the right thing. We haven't just said, like, hey,
right,
this is my club and I can do what
but
I like.
There is a free choice,
right,
and that's a key element of it. Another thing I was very surprised when I delved into it, the basic ideas of the American Revolution, you get them in Protestant oratory in this country and Protestant thought prior to the Enlightenment, prior to Locke, prior to the great philosophers, who I love them, and they're a huge element of what happened, and had an element of a huge influence on the founders. But even if you didn't have them, I think you would have had a version of the American Revolution.
This is
key. I talk about how in 1634, John Winthrop and the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they'd just been here a couple of years. They'd taken their charter from England. When the King of England says, "I'm going to come take it from you," they say, "You know what? We're going to resist you by force. We're going to have a revolution 140 years before the American Revolution."
We're going to be right back, folks. You cannot miss this.
Eyes in every storm, but the prettiest sight to see is the...
It's a marshmallow world in the winter, when the snow comes to cover the ground. It's time for play, it's a whipped cream day. I wait for it to hold you around. Those are marshmallow clouds being friendly in the arms of the evergreen trees. And the sun is red like a pumpkin head. It's shining so your nose won't freeze.
That is Dean Martin, and I was with his daughter, Dina Martin, recently, listening to her sing this song in person. It's so beautiful.
Aww.
And I have to say that in the Christmas special, the TBN Christmas special, I perform this with Victoria Jackson.
Yeah, one of the highlights, I must
she
say.
She plays the role of Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
I play the role of Dean Martin. And you know what? I look way more like Dean Martin than she looks like Sinatra, I got to say.
Somehow,
you know, she really didn't make an effort.
No.
That's the problem with Victoria. But it's such a we had such a great time. We sang Christmas carols and stuff. If you didn't see the TBN Christmas special, ladies and gentlemen, I promise you, there's just something for everybody in it. If you want to find out more details, go to tbn.org for listings in your area or whatever. But it's just on... Like, I don't know, they're playing it like seven times over the holidays. Don't miss it.
Don't.
Alvin, people are still giving to CSI.
Yes.
There is still time to give to CSI.
Yep. Still time.
I want to encourage people. Christian Solidarity International is freeing slaves in the Sudan. What an amazing thing that we have the freedom to use our money and our freedom to free those who have no freedom. They're in slavery. We know that radical Muslims in Africa believe in slavery. Their worldview doesn't say this is bad. They don't believe we're all created in God's image and we're all equal. They think that if you're a Christian, you're unequal, and they have been enslaving people for a number of decades. We have to do what we can to free these people. CSI helps us to do that. And it's hard for me even to think about this sometimes.
Yeah, I know. But I'll tell you something, what's really great is that this Christmas season, for $250 or any amount toward that, you are paying to free a human being from slavery. It's an amazing thing. And it's not just that some of these people have been enslaved for 20 years and more. But when they get out of slavery, they still have to get acclimated to life again as a free person. And sometimes the family that they are going back to didn't even know where they were for 5, 10, 20 years.
I mean, can you imagine you found out that somebody's in prison for 20 years and for $250 you could get them out. And you know that they don't belong there, that it's a wrong. that's been done to them, a horrible, horrible, horrible wrong. And you say, well, it's not my problem. Folks, this is our problem. And we can all give something. The only question is what? There's some people that can give $1,000 and not feel the pinch at all. It's all tax deductible. There's some people that can give $100. There's some people that can give $40. There's some people that can give very little. But you know what? It doesn't matter what you give. The point is, give something. Please, folks, you go to our website, MetaxasTalk.com, and you give anything. It's between you and God. But the point is, if you were enslaved, literally enslaved, wouldn't you want those people who claim to be Christians over there in the West to lift their fingers to do something? Well, this is all teed up for you. You're not having to go over and get involved. All you have to do is either write a check or make a phone call, or you can go to our website, MetaxasTalk.com, and click on the banner. Everybody can give something, and I hope you'll understand that we're all on the hook for this, folks. These people are suffering. We can do something about it. We're obliged to. The reason we have our freedom and what money we have and the things that we have is so that we can help those who can't help themselves. These folks can't do anything. And if you were in their shoes, you know you'd want somebody to do something. Yeah. Do what you can. God bless you and thank you.
If you would like to contact CSI, dial 888-253-3522. That's 888-253-3522.
And have yourself a merry